The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is November 21st, 2008. This is episode number 154 of MotoGP OD, and I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to bring you the best in motorcycle and racing and motorcycle enthusiast and motorcycle stuff and all of that sort of thing that we generally talk about. So we got a kind of a cool show today going on, a little bit off topic, you might say, but always on topic, because one thing is that the listeners definitely tend to be motorcyclists and motorcycling fans rather than just strictly MotoGP fans. So we got a call going on with Darren Carpenter, who's been on the show many times before. He's an OMRA racer and track day enthusiast and general all-around motorcycle guy, and of course a MotoGP fan as well that I know and I met through the podcast and really get along well with. So we did a call, and not so much about MotoGP. It's a little bit of everything. We talk some MotoGP. We talk about track days. We talk about motorcycle setup. We talk about club racing. The call, like I said, we just sort of decided to let it flow. And it kind of did. So it's a good call. It's interesting stuff. That's coming up shortly. Before we get to that, I want to send a big shout out. Thank you to Bob McCullough. And I hope I'm pronouncing your last name right there, Bob. It might be McCulloch, but one of those kind of names where it's spelled and pronounced completely differently. But in any event, Bob donated to the podcast. That was very, very nice. Appreciate that a lot, Bob, to help pay for the bandwidth, help pay for the beer, help pay for a variety of other things that we use here on the podcast to help things go along. We also got a donation, and unfortunately, I do not have a name. The donation thing came through, and it was just an email address for Formula1-RC.com, and that's the word formula, the numeral one, and then dash RC.com. So, of course, the first thing I did was check out the website, and what Formula1-RC.com is a website that's dedicated to the online source for Formula One radio controlled racing. So if you're into sort of radio controlled racing and all that sort of thing, here's a website that talks about doing it with like Formula One style cars. And they've got some tutorials and all that to how to set up your decals and all of that to make it look like a Red Bull RB1 or a Toyota TF105, all kinds of stuff. It was actually kind of interesting. I got very distracted looking at that. So nameless donation person out there at Formula1-RC, I appreciate it very much. And if you guys are into radio control cars or Formula One or just sort of curious like I was, take a look at that. Of course, I'll put a link up on there on the website, Formula1-RC.com. Let's see. Other stuff that we had to mention. Got some emails this week, and one of them was from Scott Jones, who's been on the show multiple times and is kind of a friend of the podcast as a big photographer. He takes some beautiful photography. And one thing that Scott did is he got together with David Emmett, MotoGP Matters, and they made the MotoGPMatters.com or MotoGP Matters. Yeah, the MotoGPMatters.com motorcycle racing calendar. And perhaps if I had done some prep, I would have known exactly what it was called. But in any case, as promised, the MotoGPMatters.com 2009 racing calendar is finally available for purchase. It's $15 US for residents of the USA or 15 euros for the rest of the world, plus shipping and handling, blah, blah, blah. This is a perfect gift or stocking stuffer for lovers of bikes and great photography. It's an indispensable aid in planning your life so that you don't miss out on any of the great motorcycle racing that we expect to see in 2009. And this is a really, really cool calendar that they've put together here with photography, which I believe the photography is all by Scott Jones. But, you know, I don't want to go out on a limb and say that, although I think it is. It's a beautiful calendar. And, of course, there's all 12 months. So for 2009, you'll be able to go January through December. And it's got the got all holidays and all that kind of stuff. And it's also got the race schedules printed out on this. This is a really, really cool calendar. So you guys got to check this out. I'm going to put a link on the website, of course, a direct link to the blog entry at MotoGPMatters.com. If all else fails, go to MotoGPMatters.com. Check out David Emmett's blog, which is fantastic stuff. The guy has some wonderful insights and really keeps up on what's going on in the world of MotoGP and racing. He had an interesting article or entry or blog post or whatever you want to call it about Aprilia's new livery for World Superbike. Which I thought was kind of cool. And then there's a bunch of other stuff on there all the time. But check out their calendar. It is really rocking beautiful. And I'm going to hook up with David and see if we can't get a couple of those calendars to maybe spice things up here on the show. But that's probably shouldn't have given that one away because now I have to do it. Oh, crap. But in any event, we will try to do that. So let's see. What else did we get in the old email bag? There was a couple of other ones that I did want to mention. One of them was about the Kawasaki comments that Jules and I were talking about last week. And this is from Bob, which unfortunately I don't have a last name, but it's Bob. And he says, I'm a big fan of your show, blah, blah, blah. He says, talking about Kawasaki, you mentioned that they build good cruisers and sport touring bikes, but did you forget about the quality and the breakthrough performance of all of the ninjas on the streets? He says, I mean, you didn't even know the name of the ZX14, which I don't remember exactly what I said in the call, if I screwed up the name of the ZX14, if I did, sorry. And how come we didn't give credit to awesome bikes like the 10R, the ZX6RR, the ZX6R, all the bikes that Kawasaki makes that the magazine talks wonders about. I was surprised about your lack of knowledge about these kind of motorcycles. And you're right, Bob, I did. I still somewhat stand behind that. I'm not knocking Suzuki's street bikes. They do make some excellent street bikes. And the like particularly the 600 class is so tight amongst all four of the Japanese manufacturers. These are all such good motorcycles that you have to be so on your game to find a serious differences between them that it does boil down to sort of personal likes and dislikes. But I was relating it to MotoGP in that I just think that Kawasaki's head is a little bit elsewhere. And I'm not saying that in a bad way or anything like that. It's just that they don't have the resources. They don't have the corporate culture. They don't have something that Honda and Yamaha do have. And now a lot of it is that Honda and Yamaha are simply bigger companies. They have a lot more money to throw at the problem than do Suzuki and Kawasaki. Now, Suzuki has chosen to put a lot of their efforts into superbike style racing, particularly AMA, where they've had, you know, Matt Mladen has just dominated, and Suzuki has done so well in AMA over the past several years that it's, you know, that this is clearly where Suzuki is putting their eggs in that basket. And Kawasaki, I mean, you can't say that with AMA. They do well in the series that they do in a variety of different sort of ways, but it's just, that's kind of what I was getting at. And so I'm not saying that Kawasaki's are bad bikes or anything like that, because they're not. They're good. They're good motorcycles. Fergus Caldicott, the guy that we just did a track day up there at Thunder Hill with, rides a ZX-10R. He loves that motorcycle. It's a really nice motorcycle. And it works, you know, it's a world-class machine. But whatever. So those are those comments there. And so Bob, didn't mean to torque you off about the Kawasaki's, but hey, you know, this is why we have the show, so that sometimes you can listen to the show and you can say, you know, oh my God, those guys, Bob and Jules, are completely on crack. But in any case, why don't we go ahead and get on with the rest of today's show, which is this call that I did with Darren. Like I said, he's got some good stuff to talk about. The call is a little bit all over the map. We sort of jump around a bit and everything else, but I think it's a good one, and I think you'll like it. I like doing it, and we had a good time chatting with Darren and everything, so we're going to go right into that right now. All right, we got Darren on the phone. How are you doing today, Darren?
Good, good. How's it going, Bob?
It's going very, very well, and perhaps I should give you a much better introduction. This is Darren Carpenter, our tame racer that races in the OMRA series, and of course, longtime listeners will know that he's been on the show many, many times before, but if you're new to the show, you may not have heard Darren. So, Darren, how you doing?
Very good.
Yes.
Thanks for the very good introduction there.
Yeah, yeah, that's actually one thing I'd kind of like to talk about, because like I said in the intro, our call today is going to be a little ad hoc, all over the map sort of a thing. But one thing that I thought was interesting is that you've bought a new race bike for next season in the OMRA series.
That's right. So my motorcycle racing history, I started off on a Suzuki SV650, raced that for 3 years, had a lot of fun. And then I bought the RC51, the Honda RC51, and raced that for 2 years. And then this last summer, I kind of took the summer off and didn't race it. I was tired of racing the RC51. It just got to be kind of frustrating because the bike I had was a 2003. I raced it in the open twin class, and so I was racing against the Ducati 1098s, and you know they've got like 30 horsepower on me, I think. So, and PIR's got a really long front straight, and so it was just frustrating. These guys would blow by you on the front straight, and then you'd really have to work hard in the corners to catch back up and pass them. But so I bought a new bike for next year. I got another Suzuki SV650. And the reason why I went back to the Suzuki is because it's pretty much, for me and for this area, I think, is the cheapest way to go racing on a somewhat modern race bike. And, you know, they don't go through tires as fast. They're not, there's a ton of aftermarket parts for them. And so you can get things for cheap. You can do things like take parts off of the Gixxers or the R6 or the, you know, the top end 600 line and put them on the SV to make them good. So, like, one of the things I'm trying to do is replace the front forks. I'm going to work on it this weekend with a friend of mine, Jeff Ford, who also races up here at OMRA, and see if we can get an R6 front end put on. So that'll help give me better brakes, and it'll get more adjustment in the front forks. And that's an easy thing to do because, you know, people with R6s, you know, they want to upgrade and get, like, Ohlin forks. And they just kind of sell their stock stuff for, you know, pennies to the dollar. So, yeah, got an SV650 and going to race it next year and see what I can do with it.
Cool, cool. So now is that going to actually expand the number of classes that you can race in? Or are you going to be fewer number of classes or what?
It'll be probably, I think I'm going to probably race it in two classes. I change my mind often about what I'm going to do with this bike, so... Right now I'm going to say one thing, and who knows if tomorrow it'll be a completely different scenario. But as of this moment, 8 o'clock on Wednesday night, I'm going to race it as a superbike. So I'll race it in two superbike classes, a middleweight superbike class, and then either a 650 GP twins, like a superbike class, or perhaps even like 600 superbike. But probably just two classes.
Okay, cool. And how do you think your bike is going to stack up, not just on a sort of a technical level? Are you going to be up against guys that have, like, Ohlins forks or guys that have, like, stock R6-type forks? Well, how do the classes work as far as that kind of thing is concerned?
Well, the two classes I'll be racing in are superbike classes, and so the rules for superbike are pretty much unlimited as long as you stay within the boundaries of the engine capacity. So I'm in a 650 class. I need to have a 650cc motor. But other than that, you can do a lot of changes to it. The super sport classes, it's a little bit different. Every club in the country, they all, you know, they're all club driven, so different members vote in different things. But for the most part, based on a production bike, and you can do less modifications to it. And I think this is true, like, around the world, besides, like, say, the top, you know, world superbike. Most of the superbike races around the world, only about 5 to 10% of those bikes are actual superbikes. You know, even if you look at, say, AMA, the American Superbike class of last year, you know, the top 10, 15 bikes are true superbikes, and the rest of them are bikes that people race in the super sport class and in superbike. They'll maybe make a change to slick tires, or they'll plug in a quick shifter, but it's basically the same bike. And so that's true at OMRA. I'll be racing in the superbike classes, but probably most of the bikes I'm going to be racing against are super sport bikes, which means I'll be able to have an advantage over them because I'll be able to make changes that they're not able to do.
Oh, that's good. So, you know, I mean, not trying to get involved with the Darren skill level or anything like that, but just a sheer, you know, like a drag race kind of a thing, which at Portland it often is, because you got such a long straight that if a guy's got a little more horsepower on you, then he's certainly going to. But that's actually somewhat less of the case in the classes that you're talking about, right? I mean, is horsepower going to be much of an issue? Or are you still talking like cornering speed, where the money that you spend on suspension is going to give you that lap time? Or is the money that you spend on your engine going to give you that lap time?
Well, you're going to need a combination of everything. You know, for the most part, even on a super sport bike, there's some guys out there that are really fast. And so even if you've got a horsepower advantage on them, you need to have some skills to get through the corners fast. The middleweight, and especially with the SV650, it's all about corner speed. So if you can get into a corner going 3 to 5 miles an hour faster than somebody else, you're going to pull a gap on them that they're not going to be able to catch you, you know, even with more horsepower. So you do need to have corner speed. You do need to have some skills. But yeah, the horsepower does make a big difference, you know, especially on the SV and at Portland, because there's a long straightaway. So if you can get off that last turn onto the front straight in, you know, even just somewhat of a close distance to the guy you're racing against, with the horsepower advantage and with the draft, you'll be able to catch up to them, you know, a little bit faster. And then vice versa, if you come out of that last corner in front of them, they're going to have a harder time catching up to you because, you know, they're just not going to have the horsepower.
Sure, sure. And I mean, not again, you know, skill being equal. Let's assume, you know, two riders of equal skill. How much factors is that going to be? Like you're talking a stock R6 fork, right? Which is a good fork for, you know, compared to the stock SV fork, which is fairly limited. You only have one adjustment and all that. In the R6 fork, you have the three adjustments, but you're still not talking the level of, you know, a really fancy Ohlins. So skill level being the same, and let's not talk about brakes yet, how much do you think that would affect things like cornering speed and stuff like that? And why is that?
Well, the forks themselves, you know, the stock SV forks, you can change the internals on it, and you can, you know, get different springs, and they put in valves or whatever in the fork. So you can actually get a pretty good performance out of the forks. Probably the difference in actual lap time, everything else being the same, would only be maybe, you know, a few tenths of a second or even less. You know, the difference between, and the reason why I'm changing is because of the adjustability. There's more adjustability with compression and dampening, and you can do some ride height changes. I was talking to a friend of mine about the front end forks, and on the stock SV, there's a rake of like 106 millimeters, where most sports bikes are down in like 95 millimeters. So it kind of brings it back into a more sport bike kind of attitude. It helps it turn in easier, things like that. But that just makes it, I think, a little bit easier to ride. You know, if it turns in easier, and if it's you know, just handles more like a sport bike. But if you were to go to, say, Ohlins, I don't think you'd get any more of a difference at all, because the problem is that if you go to some of the new generation's forks, they're the upside-down forks, which means they're stiffer. But with the SV chassis, it's a pretty soft chassis, so you know, you can only go so far before you start to kind of put things out of balance. And if you get a front end that's really stiff, you know, I'm not sure how much of an effect that's going to have if the chassis is, you know, kind of soft.
Okay, so interesting, and because that's actually one thing. I mean, on the street side of things, at least, which, you know, I'm a street guy and I'm a track day guy, and you see so many guys that all they do is ride on the street, and they never even do track days, and the first thing they want to run out is spend $1,000 on a new exhaust, and I'm like, you know, if you spent that $1,000 on your suspension, it would make your ride faster, more pleasurable, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that's always been sort of my philosophy, that suspension first, then start worrying about those kind of engine mods for that level of riding. You know, I mean, where, you know, taking out the Portland long straight and the fact that all the other racers have already done their engine mods and all that sort of thing. So I was just kind of wondering that difference between, like I said, the stock R6 fork and the Ohlins fork, you know, is it going to be that much? And the idea that you're saying where, yeah, you can stiffen up the fork all you want on the SV, but then you're going to start having the chassis kind of screwing you up because it's a little soft. That's actually super interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, we talk about suspension being like a really critical part, and that is true. But, you know, the SV650 was never really made as a sport bike. It was kind of made as like a mid or entry-level bike, you know, for the most part. It's a pretty cheap bike that they sell. I think they sell it new for like $6,000. So, you know, it's not meant to be raced, and I think it's kind of been picked up by the clubs around the country. And so You know, the other bikes, you know, we're talking about making suspension changes. I don't necessarily think people need to go out and make a $1,000 investment into, you know, Olin forks or Olin rear shock. But you really do get a huge difference just by getting the forks, the suspension that you have on the sports bikes tuned for you and for your riding style. Maybe get some, you know, respring the front or respring the back based on your weight and just the springs that are come, you know, from factory. A lot of times they're pretty soft. But you can do those things, and that's actually not that expensive, and it's a huge difference. You know, as you've known just from doing track days, you go out there on something where the suspension's not set up right, and if you just have some adjustments made, they can, you know, the stuff that comes from the showroom is pretty good stuff nowadays, and like I said, if anything, you just maybe need to respring it.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, just spending the, you know, the $20 or $40 or so on the suspension wizard at the track will make a big, big difference. You know, barring everything else, you know, you've got stock internals and all of that. Like I said, just having somebody that, you know, if if you're lucky enough to know all this yourself, well, that's one thing. But sometimes a second pair of eyes is as good as anything else. But getting a real serious suspension guy that can translate your vague sort of, well, you know, it feels a little mushy coming down the hill. And, you know, he knows exactly what you're talking about, and he makes an adjustment, and then all of a sudden it's like, wow, you know, it feels a lot better. So that can make a world of difference as well. So, and right. That was, were we talking about, like, stock bikes when they when you go buy the motorcycle at the store, you go to the motorcycle store, you buy yourself a brand new motorcycle, that these suspensions are just all over the place. They're not even close, you know, for even the average sized, I don't know what, you know, the 175 pound or 150 pound or whatever that they're sort of targeting, rider, that they're not even set up very well for that. So if you, you know, and if you weigh, you know, 205 pounds or something like that, you definitely want to do some adjustments on these, on the suspension, set your sag and all of that sort of thing. It's going to make a world of difference to the rideability of that motorcycle.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, to expect a bike from the showroom floor to be set up perfectly for you is unrealistic as well. I mean, they have settings that you can make adjustments on them. You know, there's lots of adjustments you can make. So it's almost like they're just saying, look, here's the bike. You know, here's all the knobs and switches that you need to turn to make it, you know, suit your style. And, you know, here it is. Go for it. So, yeah, a lot of times you get them home from the showroom floor, they're just not set up at all correctly. But it doesn't take much more than, like, say, the $40 or the $20 at the track. The guy turns some knobs and you're away you go, and it handles much better.
Right, right. Or even the you know, the $25 for the DVD from these guys that have the suspensions DVD. Like, I know Traction Dynamics has one, and I can't remember his name.
Dave Moss.
Dave Moss has one as well, yeah.
Right.
So, all right. Well, we've talked about this stuff before, but it's always interesting to me, these little things that you can do that make the motorcycle feel so much different. And, of course, one of the huge confidence builder that, as always, there's just nothing like this feeling is new rubber. You know, you stick on a new set of tires, and it's like a new motorcycle, you know. And I don't know if you noticed that at the racing level where you're tending to change tires more, you're using different tires and all of that. Do you find that to be true too? Basically, here's the question. Do you use your tires to that limit where they're starting to go off enough that a new set of tires feels like night and day?
I don't know about night and day, but yeah, you notice a difference. And when you're racing and you're trying to be competitive and finish in the top 10, let's say, you do notice a difference, you know, between new tires and tires that you have just even three races on them. So a lot of guys at the track, you know, the guy with the number one plate holder, he's got a deal worked out with Dunlop or Pirelli or whoever he's sponsored by. So he gets new tires every race. And if you're in 10th place, you know, if you're paying for everything on your own, it's hard to a lot of times be able to afford, you know, three sets of tires in one day if you're going to do three races. And so you get a set of tires in the for the first race, and you use them for the second race, and you use them for the third race. And by the end of the third race, you notice a difference between what they're at that point and what they were at the start of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's maybe not, you know, a huge drop-off, and different tires and riding styles, you know, make a huge difference. But, you know, it's about like an 80% drop-off. About a 20% drop-off. So, you know, at the beginning of the day, they're 100%. By the end of the third race, they're down to 80%. And you notice the difference between that 100% and 80%.
Interesting. We had an interesting conversation when we were at Thunder Hill with a tire guy, and I don't want to mention any names or anything, but if you'll recall, I was discussing that I was thinking about going to slicks for my next year's track day season, but that I would also need to then invest in a set of tire warmers, which, you know, a good set of tire warmers will set you back $300-$400. And then I was thinking that I needed these tire warmers just to keep the slicks alive. And he said, no, you really don't. What did you think of that when he said that sort of thing? Do you remember the conversation I'm talking about?
Was that at the restaurant?
Yes.
Monday night? Yeah, no, that was like 3 or 4 drinks in, I think.
Okay.
I don't remember him saying that, but I'll trust that he said that. If that's what you say, Bob, I believe you. I'm not going to call you a liar.
No. Well, I thought it was – I was a little surprised that he was saying that, you know, you really don't need to worry about – you know, the heat cycles don't matter on the set of slicks and some of these things. And it's like – I was a little bit like, well, am I – falling victim to the myth, you know, the tire myth that is he right? And the funny thing is, you know, this is the first guy that I've ever heard say this. So I was basically with that information. What do you think as far as durability of a slick, that if you're not using tire warmers, so that means they're heating it up and cooling it down. And assuming this is a track day where you're not getting those tires, you're not stressing them enough out on the track to really, really get the heat into them and all of that sort of a thing, and which is kind of what his point was, that you might not need tire warmers.
Well, I mean, I guess I can see some of his points that he's trying to make. If he's talking about just doing track days and, you're really not pushing the tires to 100%, maybe then the tire warmers don't make as big of a difference. You know, the first few laps that you're going out for a track day are usually a little bit easier. That, you know, you kind of ramp it up, because that's what most people do on track days, even if you have tire warmers. So, you know, maybe I can see that reasoning, but I still use even if I'm at a track, for a track day, I'm using my tire warmers. I use them for two reasons. One is they're warm when I first go out on the track, first lap, so I don't ever need to worry about a cold tire crash. I've had a cold tire crash before, and it's just stupid, and it easily can run $300 or $400 in the exhaust, a new muffler, new rear sets, and it's like, okay, so if I make the investment in tire warmers, yeah, it does cost $300 or $400, but if I'm going to do track days or race for the next few years, it's going to pay for itself because I'm not going to crash on a cold tire. And then the other reason why I use them is just because I think it does help the tires wear better over time. I think the heat cycling does kind of bring the oils out. And then what I've noticed is when I've had tire warmers and used them religiously, the tire will look like it's worn. It'll actually show its wear as it wears down. And so you can visibly see exactly how worn the tire is. And then other times when I haven't used tire warmers, it's almost like the tires will still go off, but they won't show their wear. And I think that maybe it's because the oils get drawn up to the surface. Maybe that helps, give a look to the surface where it doesn't look as worn as before. But in either case, I just use them for those two reasons. I think it helps with making the tires last a little bit longer. At least you can visibly see them wear out, and also just for the cold tire.
Right. And that's kind of what the philosophy that I had always thought was correct, because I'm still running street tires. I'm really happy with the Michelins that I'm running right now, that dual compound tires and all that. They work well in the rain and so on and so forth. And for my pace, I've never had much of a problem on the SV. But I did ride an SV there in St. Louis with slicks, and it was. I mean, those tires were grippy. You really could feel it was a confidence-inspiring experience. Not that the Michelins don't give me a lot of confidence. I don't know what it was. It just felt more planted. And so that's why I was kind of thinking that I might go to slicks. But then on those rainy track days, that means you really sort of need something else, or you're barely kind of dawdling around the track just because of fear of crashing. So that was my bit.
That's the thing that sucks up here is it rains.
Yes, it does.
I mean, there's nothing around. There's no way around it. And it's everybody up here would prefer days where it just rains all day long, same steady rain, for 8 hours. as opposed to, you know, what we get most of the time, which is a little bit of rain and a little bit of dry and a little bit of rain, a little bit of dry. And so you can't do anything with tires that day. You can't go out with wet tires on because if it gets into dry, you'll start to wear the wet tires out really fast. And if you're on dry tires, you know, slicks or even the racing DOTs, you can't really go very fast because it's not dry enough. So that's what we live with.
Yeah, yeah. Have you run intermediates or do you just kind of go from slicks to full wets?
I've run wets and I've run the racing DOTs and I've done slicks. I've never done any intermediates. I don't even know, I'm trying to think, like, I usually go with Pirellis, and Pirelli hasn't had, like, any intermediates available, I guess, or, you know, a lot of times, yeah, I haven't had a chance to use intermediates.
Okay, I know that, sometimes the intermediate is, you know, is a cut slick. I'm getting into stuff where I'm pretty much making it up, but they so I don't even there may not be a tire that you can purchase that is called such a thing, you know, for all I know, that's always a cut slick or not, but I thought that there was levels of
I think what most people refer to up here as intermediate is more of like a sport touring tire that you would almost get like on a bike that, you know, was like come from the showroom,
right?
Because it's kind of meant for a little bit cooler temperatures. It doesn't heat, you know, the heat cycle on those tires is at a lower temperature, so it doesn't need to get as hot. They do, you know, they don't wear out as fast if it starts to dry out. So I know racers that when it does get like that, they'll bring the tires that, you know, when they bought the bike, the tires that were on the bike, and kind of use those. That's kind of like an intermediate tire.
Mm. That makes sense. And that's a good way to save money, which is always, you know, at the track day level, at the club racing level and stuff, that's always a concern. You know, we can talk about MotoGP and sky high budgets as all day long, but for, you know, most of us, if we actually ever want to go out and ride a motorcycle, money is going to be a big factor. That's all there's to it.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this thing costs a lot of money. So, you know, I guess I see people at the track where it seems to be much less of a concern because of all the amount of money they put into it. But for me and for you and for most people I know, yeah, we're on a budget. We can't go full mines.
Yeah, it does make you wonder a little bit about what's this guy's job? How does he have so much extra money? You know, is this all he does? But yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you tell your wife about your new motorcycle, Darren? This would be a little lesson for our listeners about how we tell our wives that we bought a new track motorcycle.
Well, I think you're making reference to how I told her about my RC51.
Yes, that was interesting, but I haven't actually heard the details about how you told her about the new SV. But let's talk about both, Darren. Go ahead.
So, I was going to buy the RC51, this was 3 years ago or 4 years ago, and I already talked to the guy at the track. I looked at the bike at the track. I pretty much, you know, we made a deal and shook hands. I just hadn't wrote him a check yet. I hadn't told my wife yet, and I figured, you know, I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to buy the bike. I'm not really going to say anything. I'll just push it into the garage. Yeah, she hardly ever goes to the garage. And then if she ever does go to the garage and she's like, where did this bike come from? I'll be like, what? That red bike? No, that's been there forever. I don't even know, you know. Just kind of play it off and see how that goes. But unfortunately, I was out to dinner one night after I made the purchase, or after I shook the guy's hand. And somebody, you know, it's funny, that tells you how small the racing community is. Somebody I used to race against like 2 years previous to that sees me, he's having dinner there, he comes over, he's like, Darren, how's it going? I'm like, how's it going, Kevin? And he says, so, Chris told me you bought, you know, Sean's RC51. And I'm like, ixnay on the motorcycle, eh? So his wife was like, excuse me, you bought a what?
Which, that was an awesome story, I enjoyed that one. Did you buy the SV, though, with full spousal permission up front, or was that another surprise purchase?
No, that worked out okay. I actually kind of told her up front, not really, you know, just kind of, yeah, I'm thinking about buying a bike. And then the next day you'd be like, yeah, I talked to somebody about a bike. And then the next day it's like, you know, I think I'm going to buy so-and-so's bike. And so you just kind of keep dropping little crumbs along the way. So eventually when you're like, I told you, didn't I? I bought so-and-so's bike. I wasn't sure if I mentioned that.
Yeah.
I was like, uh-huh. So... No, it was actually one of the reasons why I took off this last summer as well of racing was just to kind of help recuperate some of my financial checkbook, bring it back into the black, and, you know, racing's so expensive. So taking a year off to help do that and saved up some money. So I was able to, that was the excuse I gave at least.
There you go. That's awesome. Plus your wife has her own fairly expensive hobby that, and so you can always hold her that over her head.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing. We won't talk about too much, but my wife does ski jouring, which is basically we have two sled dogs, and she has a harness that she puts them in, and then she wears cross-country skis, and they pull her, and they do races up with, like, 2 miles long up in the mountains. So, yeah, she's now making a sled, and, you know, we've got three dogs, and we'll be, I don't know how that'll go, but... Yeah, I can't really say anything when she comes home. It's like, oh, look what I got. I'm like, oh, great.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. When's the last time you brought your motorcycle in the house in the living room and had to have a bed?
See, I need somebody like you there, Bob, when I go to her dog sled meetings and they have me in the corner like, I can't believe you spent so much money on those things. I'm like, but those are dogs. They take so much more time and attention.
And they smell bad. I mean, I love dogs, you know, but let's get, you know, the motorcycle has this, you know, magical smell. Plus, it lives in the garage, you know, which I guess some people's dogs live in the garage. But, you know, my dog lives in the house, and it's like a constant battle of dog hair and smell and everything else. Wow, this call is all over the map. So,
well, one last thing about track days. I've thought about this before, and was that so a lot of people do track days, you know, for different reasons. And one of the things that we got an email from somebody that you forwarded to me, and he was saying how he just set a new personal best lap time for himself at Thunder Hill, which was he broke the 2 minute mark. I think you mentioned that on your podcast last week, right?
Right, I did. Yeah, that was yes.
And I just wanted to mention that you know, as people start doing track days, that's, you know, one of the things they can start to do, and a lot of people do that is they're not really racing, you know, they're not a racer, they're not out there with the club, you know, lining up on the grid when the green flag drops, but they're still, you know, they have their own ideas of things they're trying to do. And this guy, you know, sounded like, I'm not sure if he's a racer or not, but it sounded like he was just a track day guy who was really trying to get his lap times down. And that's what some people do, is, you know, you go out there and you'll notice that when you start having to focus, you know, like, you know, say your lap time is whatever, 2 minutes, or at Thunder Hill, 2 minutes and 30 seconds, like me and Bob. And, you know, you want to bring it down. Well, you know, to chop that time down, you know, you have to do it at a few seconds at a block or maybe even less. And it does really kind of teach you how to focus and how to really push your limits, you know, to get around the track. A lot of times you'll find you'll get to a certain point, and it's almost like a little bit of a wall that you have to break through to get, you know, get even faster. And as you do those things, it's very encouraging to kind of watch yourself progress along, which is what that guy did. I'm sure a 2 minute lap time is a very fast time. And, you know, it's something we do when I go to a new track, is I kind of look up the lap times that the racers have and say, okay, that's what the racers are doing. That's a really fast lap there. It gives me something to use for comparison for myself.
Right, right. And that was Adam Silver, which, sorry, Adam, your name didn't quite come to the top of my head there. It is something. I mean, it's just a gauge, because there's so many areas where you might, at a track day especially, it's a little difficult. You know, so basically, I use it as a gauge against myself. I don't really care what other people are getting. It's just like, you know, am I at least being consistent? It's not so much that, you know, am I doing better from, you know, every session so that the afternoon I'm this much faster than the morning or something like that. It's not like that. It's just like, am I going out there and at least being pretty close to the average, you know, so that, because if you're not, unless there's some specific reason like, oh, wow, I really got held up in, you know, this section because I was behind a slower rider or I missed a shift or whatever. But otherwise, if your lap times are sort of all over the map, it's kind of like, well, why, you know, what are you doing that, you know, why are you not sort of more consistent? Because this is one of the things that track days, as far as sort of teaching you how to be a good rider, and they really, really do, especially if you do a track day in the rain. A track day in the rain will give you so much knowledge that you can apply to to sensible, safe street riding. And I'm not talking about going out, you know, on the Saturday afternoon psychopath, twisty roads, you know, blind corners and all of that, which, I mean, granted, you know, we've all done those kind of rides, maybe to one limit or another, but just general street riding, it really does help improve your skills. And that's why I sort of keep an eye on the track time. It's not that I'm trying to sort of, you know, set the lap record or something like that. I use it as much as anything else of like, how consistent am I? And, you know, am I at least, you know, somewhat in the same ballpark from lap to lap rather than just being all over the map?
Right. And, you know, I mean, I know people who, racers and track day people who, they're just really, their lap times are really inconsistent. And if you follow them around the track, it's because their laps are really consistent, or inconsistent. You know, they're all over the place. They're inside, they're outside. They're not taking the same line twice. And it's like, hey, buddy, are you paying attention up there?
Right, right. So they might get, you know, now and then a really fast lap time. But it's not necessarily that they're out there being a good rider. They're out there, you know, being nuts, basically, and you know, sort of, you know, one way or another, doing something accidentally, or, you know, doing something unsafe or what have you. Because a track day is different than a race. I mean, especially with the passing limitations and all that sort of thing. And a track day is different than riding on the street. You know, so you don't want to notch it up to that same level. You know, I mean, if you're a racer guy and you're out there riding on the street with the same level of intensity that you do on the track, then you're just freaking stupid, frankly. You know, and I think, because yeah, you shouldn't do that. It's just, you just don't know with the road what's going to be around that next corner, because, you know, there could be a deer standing in the middle of the road, a little kid or a car backing out or whatever it is, you know?
Right. And that's, I mean, it's very true. I mean, I know I was talking to somebody just recently and I was saying how, you're right. Everybody's speeds on the street is a little bit different. Some people go a lot more faster than I do. I really don't care to go that fast on the street. But since I've done my track days and started racing, I haven't noticed that I've gotten faster on the road, you know, like just street riding. But I just go the same speed as I've always been going. It's just now I'm much more comfortable. I know I'm not anywhere near the limit. I know I can easily avoid whatever's going to pop up because I'm just going at a nice, easy pace.
Right. It's
the same speed I was going maybe 5 years earlier, but 5 years earlier it was a fast race. You know,
right,
fast,
right, right. You felt like, you know, oh, wow, I'm on the edge. I'm a psycho. You know, yeah, 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 exactly. I might have gotten pulled over on the freeway a while ago, and it was a plainclothes car that might have pulled me over. And he might have said that I was doing a lot of speed. And he was bitching at me that, you know what you're going to look like if you crash at that speed? And I was kind of like, well, really, you know, if I crashed at 20-odd miles an hour less, I would look almost equally bad. So, you know, that is, it's speed alone is not this big super uber demon that it's made out to be often. Which, by the way, I might not have gotten a ticket on that particular thing. I was very, very lucky. But it is. It's, you know, and the thing is that when I know that when I first started riding a motorcycle, simply going up to these kind of speeds that we're talking about was it was a thrill in itself, and it was scary, and oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm doing this. And I'm not advocating going out and breaking the law or anything like that, because I do try to keep the show somewhat sane. But let's face facts. I mean, I live in a rural area. I'm on a freeway, which, you know how freeways are engineered, and it's not even a very crowded freeway. So realistically, I was perfectly safe. But according to the letter of the law, I was an insane maniac that should be in jail. So, you know, it. And that's the kind of thing that I have developed from track days, and at the risk of sounding like, wow, now I've done track days so I can go out there and be, you know, Billy Badass, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that in this particular case, and there's a whole lot of details about this particular stop that I'm not going to go into, but they which I did tell you about it, Darren, did I not?
Yes. Did you have to blow this guy, Bob?
No, I mean, thanks, Darren. No, no. All right, fine. I'll go ahead and tell the story. I'm riding on the freeway to work, and like I said, I live in a fairly rural area. There's not a lot of traffic. And I have one section of my ride to work that is on the freeway, fairly, you know, fun with kind of some good corners and big, long sweeper corners. These are, you know, I mean, I'm not dragging knee or anything insane like that. I'm just kind of having fun, right? And going up the hill.
What's the posted?
Limit? 65 here in Oregon. And going up the hill, I had a long story short. I thought that this little silver car was trying to keep up with me. And I had passed this little silver car, not unsafely, but aggressively. And so it's like, well, that's never really good, because if little silver car catches up with me, you know, I mean, the best, he might give me the finger, or he might do something really stupid like try to run me off the road. So basically, I need to lose little silver car. So I sort of notched it up a bit. Still, like I said, not feeling unsafe at all, feeling completely, totally mega confident in how I was riding and all of that. And I thought completely safe, but apparently, you know, bad enough that I would have lost my license and all of that, because little silver car flips on his damn hidden lights, pulls me over. And I was like, oh my God, I totally didn't make this guy for a plainclothes cop. He gets out and he's, did you know how fast you were going? And you know, it's like, well, you know, I wasn't really looking at the speedometer. I was going to pinch into the road. No, sorry. Whatever.
You should have told him you were running for your life.
Yeah, I said, I thought you were trying to catch up to me and I was just trying to lose you. Long story short, I think that the guy may have been a motorcyclist himself. And once he sort of got past that initial, you know, I can't believe you're such a scofflaw, you know, and he basically let me off with a huge warning. And it did. And it's the warning that I got wasn't so much that I felt like, oh my gosh, I was so close to death and the adrenaline is nothing like that. It was nothing like that, because this is a problem, and I'll get to this one here in half a second. But the warning that I got scared me, because I don't want a ticket that big. So I've been a little more safe and sane. But, and we had this conversation, you and I, Darren, is a little bit like, you know, hey, I'm a 40-year-old guy, granted, not the reactions of a 20-year-old, but also on the other hand, my reactions are a lot better than a 70-year-old. And I'm on a motorcycle that can stop in half of the distance, or way less, actually much less, than a big old heavy Buick. Why should I be beholden to the same speed limit as the 75-year-old lady who can't see driving the 25-year-old Buick that's leaking oil all over the place? And the thing is my point has always been that it's stupid. So whatever, but that doesn't matter in the law. And the other point that I did want to make, and this is a fact, and anybody out there that's listening, and I'm not condoning driving like a maniac or riding like a maniac on the roads. I really, really do not think that's okay. Because you guys all know I'm in the Navy Reserve, and this has been a big, huge push, especially with like the Marines and the Army and stuff. These guys come back from Iraq and they're adrenaline junkies. They go out and they buy themselves an R1 and then they wrap it around a tree because they're not riding within the limits of the road and their abilities and everything else. And so, you know, we're losing literally last year, more guys in the Navy died in motorcycle accidents than died in Iraq. So,
yeah.
And that's the part where it is. And I know that, yes, I'm being bad, but on the other hand, I also know that I'm being safely bad. And now if I lived in Portland, I would ride completely differently because there's so much more traffic.
Right.
And in fact, actually, I probably wouldn't ride that much like you and Fergus, that you just don't ride that much on the street because it's just not that much fun.
Right, and I mean, the advantage for me and Fergus is we have Portland International Raceway is less than 10 miles away. We can easily go there for almost any track day during the summer and, you know, races on the weekend. So we've got just a jewel here right in the city of Portland. Not a jewel because it's such a spectacular track, but just the fact that it is a track within the Portland city limits that's just very, you know, very rare.
Right.
And, yeah, we don't drive on the street as much just because it's, you know, pain in the ass to drive on the street. You're always behind the car, you know, it's just, you know.
And yeah, I have I-5 just down the street. I like it a lot, but no. So, you know, at the risk, like I said, of getting a bunch of email and all of that, I really don't think I'm unsafe. I'm sure that there are plenty of cagers that I've passed that think I'm a you know, flaming idiot and all of that. And to a point, they're probably right. but I keep it safe, and I do keep it mostly relatively sane. That particular stop that I'm talking about was an unusual incident, and it was because I thought the guy was trying to catch me up. So now that we've gone down with the whole history of Bob being a complete asshole on the street, it is. Portland is. And if you haven't ridden a lot of tracks, Portland is still, I still enjoy Portland, even though, yes, it is technically less of a track than, say, Thunder Hill or something like that, because there's no elevation change and because it's primarily right turns with only one real left. It is a little bit, but it's still fun. It's still a lot of fun as a track.
Yeah, I mean, the things I like about Portland is the fact that it is a top scale track. I mean, and what I mean by that, again, it's not so much the layout of the track, but you know, we've got a full pit area in the inside of the inside. We've got a full, you know, tower. They've got electricity that people can use. There's, you know, there's a concession stand. There's two outhouses. I mean, you have a lot of facilities there. You know, they do kart races there. Back in the heyday, they would have like 80,000 people out to watch the kart races. So it's a real track. You know, unlike say other tracks where you know they just don't have a facility. Thunder Hill is a great track, but there's no power on you know in the pit, so you can't run your tire warmers unless you have a generator. So it's little things like that. I mean, Thunder Hill is also a very nice track, but you know, I've been to Spokane. Spokane's just this track out in the middle of nowhere, and like, it's a nice track, but there's just you know, the facilities there are awful. And yeah, I mean, it's also Portland is just right in the city. And you know, again, it's just not very many times that you can go to the track and just be just a few minutes from stores and shops and restaurants.
It is unusual that a track is so close to the actual population center of the town. And Portland is. It's literally, it's in a, was it a city park or a state park or whatever? It's basically a park. And I mean, it's right there. And could, you know, during your 1 hour lunch break on your track day, you could go to, you know, Burger King or whatever. It's just down the street.
Right, and that's the one thing that I think a lot of people in Portland wish that the mayor and the city council would kind of recognize the jewel that we have and would try to make it, you know, try to promote it more, maybe try to bring in some big-time races, or maybe invest just a little bit more money into the track to really make it just a world-class track. Mm-hmm. You know, if they did that, like I said, there's just not that many road courses that are that close to any cities. I mean, if you think of, like, Pacific Raceway is about, I don't know, an hour and a half from Seattle. Thunder Hill is maybe an hour Sacramento. You know, Infineon Raceway is like, an, you know, so all these tracks that I'm naming, they're just not really close to any kind of, you know, any kind of city or facilities. And, you know, at Portland International Raceway, you can take the light rail, the Metro out to the, or the TriMet out to the track and then jump on it and run right back downtown. And so, yeah.
Yeah,
I wish they would actually utilize it some more.
And Portland is certainly, I mean, for AMA, I mean, like you said, CART used to race there, and I think AMA could put on a good show in Portland, and it's better than some of the tracks they race at now, as far as you know the layout and all that. It's better than some of the crappy Rovals, where you know, you've got literally you know cones and hay bales marking the track. You don't see that at Portland.
No, and you know, the track as it is right now, they just did a resurface last year. It's got the best surface on it that I think I've seen at any track.
It is awesome.
And there are some areas that are some safety concerns. I know if, let's say, AMA wanted to come here or some other big national race would want to put on a race on here, there are some safety issues, but it really wouldn't take very much money to kind of move some walls and move some things around. To even clear those up.
Right. The biggest problem would probably be coming off turn 9.
Turn 9 and turn 5, 6, you know, that back straight, there's a wall along that.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
When you come out of turn 4, you're at full throttle, and you're basically driving straight towards a wall. Now, the wall at that point is several feet, several hundred feet away. But by the time you kind of make the S around 5 and then back onto the back straight, you know, you're passing the wall right there.
Right.
So, you know, those are the two spots. And turn 9 also. But it wouldn't take a lot of money to kind of reconfigure that space. You know, those are just some areas that you could fix.
Right. And I think, like, at the AMA level, it probably would want to even run, like, the festival chicanes, what we call the festival chicanes, which CART used to run to slow you down going into turn one.
Right.
The motorcycle turn one. And, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, those are, like you said, they're fairly inexpensive, you know, on a that level of speaking, fairly inexpensive fixes. And, you know, Portland is a big city. So yeah, cause I got got an email talking about going to Miller for World Supersport and World Superbike, and saying that, you know, that, yeah, this is a fantastic, beautiful track, just awesome, but it's in Tooele. And you know what people do in Tooele at night? You know, nothing. And so it's just so far out in the middle of nowhere. And also that some of the facilities at the World Superbike races in Miller, there was no like major big infield where there's vendors, you know, selling helmets and calendars and all the crap that they sell. And, you know, that's part of the draw for a race, is that you have this sort of whole experience. You're not just there only for the on-track action. It's also sort of a gathering, if you will. I always like that. I always take a quick lap through the vendors' booths and stalls and stores and all of that. And I also enjoy, of course, you know, getting something to eat and having a beer and finding motorcycle people to talk to and all of that sort of thing. And apparently this was a little lacking at the World Superbike round there in Miller.
Well, maybe it's just the first year. Hopefully things will improve, you know, next year. You know, I was talking to somebody, maybe Fergus, about, I don't know if it'll actually work out, but, you know, a weekend motorcycle trip I would love to do, and if it could work it out, is go to the World Superbike races in Miller and then stay for like a track day on Monday or Tuesday. That way you get to see some really fast racers on, you know, the weekend, and then, you know, learn all their lines and go out and set some lap records on Monday or Tuesday on the track day.
Some lap records, yeah. So I think that Miller is one of those tracks where it would be simply awesome to ride the track. And I mean, it's a beautiful facility. And if the promise comes through, we actually have, I don't think it's quite Miller quality, but we have a pretty exciting track coming here in Oregon in the Dalles, which, what is that called? Oregon Motor Park or whatever they're calling it.
Yeah,
or something like that.
And Oregon Parkway Motors Raceway or something.
Yeah, anyway. And I'll find the link and I'll put it in there. But it's that is kind of an interesting looking track for you know, to race on. I mean, it looked good. They've got a nice surface and all of that sort of thing. But it's like one of these country club kind of places, rather than it's not like PIR where it's in a park.
It's about, I think, about 2 hours away from Portland.
It's in the middle of nowhere. Yeah,
it's in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything around there. And right now, they've just got the track laid out. I believe the whole track has been paved, asphalted. And so now I think they're dealing with, like, runoff. But they're still, you know, it's still very lacking. There's no... I think to get to the track, it's a dirt road still, to get out to the pit area. And, you know, there's no facilities really there. So they've got the track. I've heard about this track maybe 2 years ago, and I think 2 years ago, me and a lot of other people were like, I don't know if that'll ever happen. So just this last summer, we started seeing pictures that were actually, like, it had tarmac down, and there was some pictures of some motorcycles, and I've even heard of guys, know some guys that have done a few laps there. And they say it's a great, you know, surface, a great track. So I think the Oregon Motorcycle Club, OMRA, is going to look into doing some kind of race there if possible. They talked about, I think there's been talk about maybe having a race there this next September, and just have it kind of like a no points weekend, you know, first time out kind of thing to give it a trial run. But yeah, if that works out, that'll give us two racetracks in Oregon. And not too far away. I mean, I'm not sure how far away that is for you.
It's getting up there in distance, because basically the best way to get up there is to go up to Portland and cut across. There's no sort of direct, you know, hypotenuse of the triangle sort of method. So you're looking at probably a 4 or 5 hour drive, I think. But you know, I mean, I'd go up there, and you're right though, that the infrastructure is the part that they're lacking there, because they do. It's been paved. It's just that there's nothing else. There's no, you know, pit area. There's no, apparently there's no access road even. So, you know, it's still a work in progress.
Right. And I think the big hurdle that needs to be addressed, and I think people have been talking about this already, is just what to do for emergency service. You know, whenever you have a track day or a race day, you have to have medics on. You don't have to, but really you need, you know, a paramedic on site. And if you need a trauma one, you know, where are you going to go?
Right.
There's not really, you can get a helicopter ride to Portland. So there's some things there that need to kind of be figured out where people are going to go for service, emergency service.
Right. And unless you have that, you know, a helicopter actually on standby and stuff like that, that could be a long time. You know, if there's a helo sitting there, yeah, you're talking a few minutes to get to Portland. Well, relatively few minutes.
Well, but the thing is, if you're, let's say if it's a race day, track day is a little bit different because it's just a track day. So you're going to tell people in the morning, look, this is a situation, so take it easy. But on a race day, you know, if you have a helo sitting there and somebody gets injured, well, the race day pretty much ends until that helo comes back.
But that's also, I mean, it's particularly at the club level of racing, that's going to be kind of, that's the chance you take. That's the price you pay, you know? I mean, and unless you are lucky enough to be racing in Portland, that's in the middle of town, pretty much, there's not much other choices.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess, we talked to somebody about Willows. There's a Trauma 1 center there, wasn't there, for Thunderbolt?
In Willows? I thought they would have to take people to Reading.
I don't remember now.
Yeah.
I thought that was somewhat close, but maybe not. Yeah, it's a dangerous sport.
Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, we've discussed that one a lot. What have you come up with about AMA?
Well, the one thing I was just kind of talking to some local racers about that might do nationals or have done nationals in the past, and have been asking people what their opinion is about the new AMA structure with the Daytona Motor Group and what's going on. And one thing I've heard that is a little bit different is a lot of club racers, I think, are going to look into going to some of those AMA races. The one thing that they're doing different is the payout. And we've talked about this earlier in the summer.
Right.
And I think before when I talked about the payout, I was kind of dissonant, saying it wasn't really enough to make it worthwhile. But it actually is a big difference. I think, if I remember correctly, the payout is going to be something like for second place down to 20th place, everybody gets the same, and everybody gets like $5,000, you know, for finishing in the top 20.
Right. And if I recall, your point was that, you know, that if you're coming from clear across the country and everything, you're going to blow through that $5,000 real quick.
Yes. And that was my point. But the one thing to consider is previously, years before, racers would do that and they would blow $5,000. And if they finished in 10th place, they would get a payout of like $100.
Right.
So that makes a huge difference if you're having to pay, you know, $4,800 just to race in a race and finish in 10th place, as opposed to, you know, being able to race for free because you're probably going to get some help from sponsors and if you can finish in the top 20. So I think there's some guys that are like, you know, they've never raced, they haven't done nationals before, they're really fast club racers, or maybe they have done some nationals but they weren't able to afford it, that now they're like, hey, I might be able to afford this. And if I get some help from some sponsors and if I can finish in the top 20, so I think it's going to be kind of interesting, at least for me, to watch the AMA next year just to see how I think we're going to get a lot of new you know, faces in the AMA coming up from the clubs. I'm not sure if they're going to be as fast. You know, I'm sure they won't be as fast as the fastest, you know, factory guys as usual. But, you know, and it also depends on how they present that race or that sport. You know, it's entertainment on television, and hopefully they kind of cover more of that. That's one thing I wish they would do more often, is they usually don't talk about anybody outside the top 10.
Right.
And I think they kind of took some time to kind of educate the viewer on who these guys were and kind of give them a vested interest, you know, and the guy who's fighting for 15th place. People would start to kind of notice this more, and I think it would help improve the sport, at least bring in some more viewers. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to see. And I think there's also going to be a class for racers age 16 to 21, and it's going to be like a 600cc bike, probably very limited, almost a production bike that they have to use. But that's also going to be interesting because you're going to get a lot of guys, young guys, that are going to come up, you know, that you wouldn't have seen before because they wouldn't have been able to afford to go to the AMA and do races. But if there's, you know, if they're making payouts that big, it's going to afford, you know, a lot more guys who couldn't in the past do it. And it'll be interesting to see how that turns out.
Right. Now, they're going to come out because the rules, this is part of the problem with the whole Daytona Motorsports group, is that the rules have still not been finalized. That's going to be supposedly happening, well, actually right about now. I think in November 20th, if I recall, the last thing I read in Cycle News was that they were going to come out with yet another "this is it" rules package. And I think that is one thing they wanted to do, was open it up to more people. You know, maybe not just the average Joe Schlub, but, you know, a dedicated club racer, semi-pro level, if you want to call it that, that sort of a thing. And that would be really cool. But it's still, you know, the factories want superbike, you know, like we used to have superbike status, where you've got, you know, world-class names, world-class bikes, you know, basically a lot of money involved and all of that. And that's definitely what the factories want. And by and large, that's what the TV viewing audience wants. Because, you know, even in a superbike, you know, talking last year's class structure, superbike is what got the viewership. You know, the other classes like Super Stock or Formula Extreme and all of that were barely covered. And I mean, actually, it was a fairly expensive proposition to run a bike in Formula Extreme. So that's going to be a bit of a concern from the side of like Speed Channel or ESPN or whoever decides to pick this up. So what Daytona Motorsports Group wants and what actually happens may still be a little bit of a, there might be a bit of a distance between those two things.
Yeah. And I agree. You know, it's unfortunate they haven't come out with the rules yet. I was talking to a motor builder just this last month or two, and was asking him what guys are doing that normally race in the Nationals. And he was saying that, you know, it's just frustrating because nobody wants to build a bike for next year because they don't know if it's going to be legal or not. And so it's really, the small shop builders and motor builders and bike builders that, you know, do high-end bikes for a club and for national racers, they're all kind of on hold. You know, they're kind of waiting for those to come out, and that's unfortunate they haven't done that yet. You're right. I think it's going to be hard to see or hard to tell what's going to happen this next year, which factories are going to jump on board. I think Yamaha has announced that they're going to have a team, but there's some other teams as well that you're kind of like, you're not sure what's going to be around. So there's still a lot of ifs. There's a lot of questions up in the air. Right. And next year, the year after that, it's going to be some transition for sure.
Right, right. And I mean, that it does remain to be seen a little bit. And, you know, like this week's Cycle News that should actually be being mailed right now. I think the online edition is available on Wednesdays. Might give us some more insight on all of that. But I think that there is still going to be some hammering out because, frankly, the sport as a whole, you know, if you want AMA motorcycle racing, is not going to go very far without significant factory support. There's been other series like Formula USA and all of that have come and gone because, you know, without the big factory support and the big factory dollars and the commercial time and all of that, they don't get TV time and they just don't get the money. So, you know, you can say all you want that we're going to have big purses and it's going to be so great in this sort of, you know, racing utopia. But unfortunately, until somebody comes along and can justify the expense of a factory involvement because the, you know, race on Sunday, sell on Monday, which Suzuki has done very well for quite a long time, it's just not going to happen. And I hate to be negative and all of that, but it's just the way it is. So.
No, I think you're right. But I think... like I said, I think it's just going to take a few years for this to work out. I don't know how it's going to work out in the end. I'm hoping that what we'll do is something what happened with World Superbike, where in the beginning when they went to a control tire, a lot of the manufacturers were upset and pulled out, and there was some transitional years there. And, you know, now next year I think there's going to be like 14 factory bikes on the grid, and it's really improved. And so, you know, I think AMA... the biggest thing that they need to do is to try to make the show better, you know, present it better on TV, Like I said, maybe I'm not the same as everybody else, but I wish they would spend a little bit more time maybe showing some qualifying or just giving some background on these guys.
I agree. I'm 100%. Speed's coverage of MotoGP is a perfect example. It's like, you know, please, you know, give us the grid walk, a little bit of the grid walk. And I agree.
Yeah, and that's the thing with, you know, I started watching Formula One just this last year, basically because I started listening to the Formula One blog. And, you know, they do a better job of putting that on TV. I mean, you get more of the grid walk. They talk about the bike, they talk about the cars, and they give you more strategy information. And maybe they do that to help make the racing more interesting, because a lot of times there's not as much action on the actual race. So it's more like a baseball game where they, you know, there's not a lot of action and there's more talk about what's going to happen or what just did happen than actually seeing stuff happen.
Yeah, Formula One is a lot like baseball. Sorry.
But I wish they would do more of that with the motorcycle racing. You know, it's unfortunate they don't try to grow the sport.
I agree. Once you get to know these guys, I mean, no secret that I'm a big Nicky Hayden fan, but if you've sort of seen the guy and they've talked to him on the interviews and all of that, and you've seen what a real and genuine person that most of these guys are. Jake Zemke is another example of a guy. This guy is just a neat guy, you know? And I think that does help also, that then you know who you want to root for. You know, if you've had a sort of a chance to watch some kind of inside story about Jake Zemke or Ben Spies or the Boston brothers or whoever it is, that, you know, you've seen them and it's like, oh wow, you know, they're, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so the next thing you know, you're rooting for them to win or do well or what have you out on the track.
You know, it's also like talking about the personalities. I mean, MotoGP right now, they've got some real personalities with Rossi and Jorge Lorenzo and John Hopkins, and you know, they have the stars there. They just need to put them on TV.
Yeah,
present them better.
Exactly. Well, all right, Darren. I think that about kind of covers it. We've gone to just about an hour now, so why don't we go ahead and kind of call it a day and see where we're at.
Sounds good to me.
Right on. It's always a pleasure having you on the show, Darren. I do appreciate it. A lot of good stuff, and enjoy talking to you. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Talk to you later, Bob.
Bye. All right, that's going to do it for tonight's show. Hope you enjoyed it. Always good to have Darren on the show. Like I said, that call was a little bit all over the map, but I still had fun doing it, and I hope you had fun listening to it. So thanks very much for downloading the show. Thanks to everybody that donated. Thanks again to Darren. Next week, we've got some good stuff going on. Got a call with Liam that we're hoping will happen. We're not 100% sure. Liam Schubert's schedule is always a little bit topsy-turvy and everything, but Jules is supposedly going to be doing a call with Liam. We'll see if that works out. And we've got some future stuff planned for the rest of the off-season. So we'll still be around, probably take a few weeks off here and there for the holidays and all of that sort of thing. But other than that, the show will go on. MotoGPOD will be here through the off season, welcoming you, working you through the long, dark winter until we get our MotoGP and World Superbike and possibly AMA and British Superbike and whatever it is in your area of the woods. Seasons going on in the, sort of early spring when they all starting up again. And of course, there's testing between now and then. So, whatever. Between now and then, keep the shiny side up, the rubber side down, and we'll talk to you again next week. Well, seeing as this show doesn't seem to be about MotoGP very often anymore, I'm not even sure that I really need to mention all of this stuff, but I sort of feel semi-obligated because I'm always doing it and it's part of the name. So I'm going to just let you know real quick that MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, that's me, and I'm solely responsible for its content. So even when I sound like a complete idiot, it's just me. All of the guests and everything on the show are pretty smart, erudite individuals. I'm the one who makes the rest of the show sound sort of like a Laurel and Hardy routine. And I just want to let you know that MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL in any way, shape, or form. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.